Welcome to Creative Innovators. Please enjoy this podcast series. It is really about where to take your career. Yes, you're going to be listening to great people who are doing crazy and amazing things across sometimes wide and diverse careers. But it's really a place to get inspired. My name is Gigi Johnson, and I'm so glad to have been building this podcast across 2020, a year that will live in some kind of infamy. But hopefully you've built some ground speed. Go back, listen to past episodes, and listen to all sorts of great directions people have taken their careers in a wide variety of creative enterprises, different types of occupations. Come join us. And also feel free to go to creativeinnovatorsclub.com, our new space where we're going to be gathering people to take a look at how do I build my next creative career? And we've got new classes for rebuilding your creative career for 2021. Come join us at Creative Innovators Club, and you can see all sorts of great tools that go with this toolbox of creative innovators. I'm excited to bring Dave Bogan to the table. I have been a friend of Dave's for a few years, and I've got to see many facets of Dave Bogan, including his current role as head of third-party partnerships at the MLC, the New Music Licensing Collective, one of the new adventures for 2020 and 2021 for the streaming music world. He's able to bring a whole set of relationships in creative industries, as well as the ability to be and understand and experience as an entrepreneur, creating music technology companies, creative companies, flipping them in some cases multiple times, and now bringing this into a major organization. So Day is a great model of how to pivot and change and expand your territory and expand your relationship. So enjoy this session with Day and think about what could you do that combines different people and territories, that recombines ideas and looks for new changes in the world that you can build with a creative business. It's the sense of time nowadays is so warped, right? So it's like, when are we and where did we meet and what's going on? And my first memory of you is just being so fabulously diverse and persistent.
Yeah.
And to me, that still
persistent. I definitely was persistent. I insisted that young entrepreneurs or future entrepreneurs needed to take a class like this, because I was working with so many young founders like myself, also a young founder, but worked with a number of young founders who were building really interesting tech ideas, music apps, social media apps, apps for gamification that touched music in some way. That when that touched music, that music required a lot of for them to understand the intellectual property implications of how it touched their app, basically, and understand what it meant to license music and to deal with artists. And I felt that this type of class was needed because there were so many computer science majors or students who were interested in building apps who didn't have any background or experience in music industry. And I felt that, hey, UCLA had this UCLA Center for Music Innovation, which you ran. And I thought this is the perfect platform to offer something like this.
And you're one of the many people that I know, but one of the most intense ones, who are chronically looking for new solutions to bring people together around new solutions. And I find that fascinating, because you see opportunities where other people don't yet see that there's something coming together.
I appreciate that, because that's actually been a blessing and a curse. As a founder, as a serial entrepreneur, I have come up with many solutions to problems that I've identified within, you know, the fields that I've operated in and worked in. And those solutions have been warped into business ideas, and those business ideas I try to vet into potential companies. But I've in the past, I've been too early to the market. And that's generally the case when you have the someone that's innovative, is that sometimes you can be too early to market. It even goes back to when I was in my late teens and came up with an idea and a website called Donate Me Nile. DonateMeNile.com. I built the website, and the idea was about people who could, may need to raise money for any given issue, would seek donations. And obviously, partly I didn't have the funds and resources to promote it, but I built a website. It had a website, and you could set up, connect your PayPal to it and create a page and run a campaign and get donations. And then 10 years later, it was GoFundMe. So,
and it's many competitors, right?
So, and it's many competitors.
Yeah. It's interesting. So there was I've been teaching at UCLA now for 21 years in digital disruption. And one of my favorite speeches was Sky Dayton, after I think he had his second or third not great success after Earthlink, who was talking about how it's like you're surfing a wave, and it's just as easy to be in front of the wave or behind the wave as on top of the wave. And a lot of it is that you might see things early and not be at the right place. There's just be too early. And this whole first mover adoption thing has right. a lot of foibles to it, that you want to be at the right time at the right place. So can you, I know that you've been an entrepreneur since you were a pup. When was the first thing you started?
So the first time I started to make money from my ideas was in middle school, when I started selling cakes that I would bake and play with the icing and add cinnamon to the batter and different things for fun. But then in high school, I started making money again off of putting together tours or shopping trips from Cleveland, Ohio to New York. Which is certainly much more of a business than selling little slices of cake in middle school, and convinced my mom to allow me to put this together. So I was only 16 years old, but I did all the work. I chartered the bus. I made the flyers. I promoted the trip. I sold the tickets. I made the itinerary. I contracted the driver, and so forth. So I did all of the logistics in regards to this little venture that would make me a couple $100 every few weekends.
So what did your parents think of this? Are they, or were they entrepreneurs?
Both my parents were entrepreneurs. My mom had a full-time job, but outside of that, she was entrepreneurial in sort of the fashion retail world. She had a small boutique where she would go and source accessories and then sell those accessories in her boutique. My dad was an entrepreneur in the music industry, which is what I am now. He had a small record label and publishing company and an artist management company, and was trying to build an empire as a music entrepreneur to find talent, develop talent, put them in shows and on the road. The traditional small mom and pop label operations in the Midwest, and I would see that as a kid. The artist and the shows and my dad traveling and, learning the words music publisher and learning the words record label, and not necessarily the business of music, but learning conceptually that these were two different entities.
And you're a musician as well, right?
And I was a musician, a singer, put into a group with my brothers. And my dad managed us and wrote our songs and, rehearsed us. He's also a vocalist, a singer, and a instrumentalist. We're sort of like, instead of the Jackson 5, we're just the Bogan 3 or something. But we're a little group, and that was when we were younger, before we could decide whether or not we really wanted to do this as for a career. My two brothers decided no. Later on, I decided yes. This was a career that I wanted. I wanted a career in the music industry. I continued, through high school, training as a vocalist. It was interesting because my guidance counselor recognized in high school that I had these two parallel sort of career trajectories going on. One was my interest in the arts as a singer and choir and honors choir, as an actor, because I also pursued acting and did the school plays and the school musicals. So I had this creative passion that I had been nurturing. But then simultaneously, I was also very much a leader. I was in a number of student groups. I was an officer of those student groups, making decisions with our with my co-officers, took on initiatives in school, created initiatives, created programs. So she was, you know, I remember her telling me, and also my best friend's mom telling me that, "You're going to be a businessman." I remember saying, "No, I'm not. You know, I like singing. I like acting. I want to be the talent." But I had these two passions. One I didn't really understand, which was my entrepreneurial acumen, the skills that I was developing in my youth that have been applied to me developing business ideas and me running businesses and companies. And then also this creative, appreciation of the arts. Luckily, I get to bring that together now, having built businesses in the music industry where I'm respecting music creators and supporting music creators and empowering music creators. So it's almost like I was on these two different journeys in parallel until my adulthood, and they kind of came together. Where I became a music entrepreneur, building businesses to support music creators, and still very much involved in the creative process when I managed artists.
So before we get to that, the other seed I hear from this part of the story is that you didn't need safety as a teenager, that you were willing to step out of the box and not wait to become something, but were willing to step out and take risks. And you did several different ventures between when you were a teenager and through the end of college. How did you even then evaluate the risk of doing a new venture?
Yeah, I certainly have taken on risks in terms of actual economic liability for ideas, even as a teen. You know, I didn't know I was going to sell these tickets for this bus ride. I had to need to recoup if I didn't, because this bus is $600. So I always, I guess I felt that taking on trying to materialize an idea that I was super passionate about, investing in that opportunity was much more important than the potential loss. I felt that it would be more a loss to me not to pursue something that I felt was vetted well. Now, I've gotten better at vetting ideas well. And now I teach that, how to vet an idea and look at the market size and so forth. But in the beginning, it was simply, I have an idea. I'm passionate about this thing. I can structure it into something that I can package and deliver to friends and family as a service, when I was in high school, middle school, or later on as a business, in college, and just going for it. I didn't really take the time to sit and think about what happens if you fail. I didn't want to, focus on that. I really wanted to focus on trying to execute. I'm hoping that, the execution, that the outcome is good. Sometimes it wasn't, but in those moments I've learned and took those failures or setbacks as lessons that I can apply to the next thing, to help me vet the next thing better or to help me execute the next thing better. So I'm certainly risk adverse.
We were talking actually fairly recently with my class. Thank you for joining and talking to my students. That you've sold four companies and started 10?
I've started, and I did this a couple of years ago on LinkedIn. I sat down for a day and I went all the way back to the very first business idea that that I developed, and the very first you know, real business where I started to generate revenue. And there were somewhere between 10 and 15 businesses. And they all sort of fall into the greater entertainment umbrella industry because, you know, some things were, I had a few years that I worked in the event space, producing, creating and producing events with, you know, DJs or live acts, live artists. I had a promotion company where I promoted venues in Hollywood and Los Angeles. So I just had a number of different businesses. Some of those I created while I was in college at UCLA. As a matter of fact, it got to a point where I was at UCLA and I was making $14,000 a month as a student doing event production and club promotions and brand activations on behalf of brands trying to reach the college market. And I remember this vividly because I was measuring the revenue growth that I was doing against the change in my grades. And so I sat down one quarter because when I started UCLA, when I transferred into UCLA, I transferred as an honor student, graduated with honors from my community college and transferred in and was accepted into the honors college at UCLA. Had a 4.0 my first quarter, just on the dean's list at UCLA. So I was at one point somewhere in my senior year, I sat down and looked back at my transcript and I was looking at, and I wanted to map the decline in my grades and the quality of my grades against the increase in revenue that I was making over time. And it wasn't a substantial decline, but you go from all A's one quarter to all A's and a B or all A's and two B's or something. You see that you're still doing well, but you're not, it was very interesting for me because, I was trying to understand, I'm in college to develop the skill sets and to develop the knowledge and to apply these things to eventually get I was asking that question, is it eventually to get the career that I'm currently doing or to advance in the career that I'm currently pursuing as an entrepreneur while I'm a student? So it was a very kind of existential time. But ultimately I felt that, I was taking on these risks, like I had been since I was a kid, just even going to, pay for a box of, cake mix and some ingredients that I wanted to come up with to make interesting cakes. That was a risk if I wasn't going to, make back my allowance money that I used to invest into these ingredients to make cakes, all the way to, college. I chose not to get a student job to pay for, my expenses, and I rather built a business, and that business evolved. By my senior year, by my last quarter, I had a real legitimate music company and was working with major brands, major music companies. There's, like you said, there's the idea that this might not work out, but I didn't allow that idea to stop me from trying.
And the other thing, which knowing a bit of your journey, that it also seemed that you shifted from the, I am the secret sauce inside my company, to looking at companies that you could take yourself out of. But I think through college, you were the secret sauce in a lot of these ventures, your initiative, your connections, being able to put something together uniquely, and then moved into more of a tech facilitated, I can build something someone else can use. Is that part of your journey story?
100%, yes. Because I think when I look back at the various businesses that I've started, and I've had some very interesting business ideas. There was one called Go-Go Mannequins. I remember I still have the logo for that.
Go-Go Mannequins.
And I still have the promotional video because when I used to promote clubs, nightclubs in Hollywood, they had go-go dancers and some of them were my friends. And I also had a marketing company at the same time, a marketing consultancy at the same time. This is also, I was a student at UCLA at this time, but I had a marketing business and I would help local businesses with their marketing, whether restaurants or retail. And for one retail shop on Melrose Boulevard, we put go-go dancers in the window. We took out the mannequins and put go-go dancers in the window. And then the business was called Go-Go Mannequins. So it would draw attention to the storefront and therefore drive traffic into the store. And that would
And increase sales.
Yeah.
Wow. So
that was one of my ventures. And I still have the little promotional video for this. So there's a lot of different, just kind of interesting. The difference is that these were solutions, you know, very specific solutions to an issue, right? Our objective for the retail store is to drive revenue, to increase foot traffic. And the solution to that was to put go-go dancers in the window, and wearing what the mannequins would have been wearing. And I had a lot of different businesses like that. And like you said, I was the secret sauce, right? It was a creative execution. It wasn't a product that I left, you know, that someone can sell, that someone could buy. So when I shifted in 2012 to start working on my first tech startup, which also came out of, you know, dealing with trying to build a solution to a problem. My first music tech company was called Songbank. And it came out of this issue that I had when I, at the time I was managing songwriters. I had a small publishing company, and a small management company and a record label. I was managing songwriters.
Not that you really needed more to do, right?
So, right.
it's so funny because, I mean, there's interesting lack of research on the fact that many people in creative industries have or run many different companies and wear different hats. So you're kind of an interesting example. Yeah, of that.
Yeah, simultaneously, because I actually had a day job, and running those businesses was not my main, was not my primary income, nor was it, you know, what took up most of my time during the day. I had a day job as a VP of marketing and strategic partnerships of a retail chain. But at my role and the dynamic of my role at this particular company was one in which I could create and execute on ideas. It was very much a intrapreneurship opportunity where I could develop concepts for the company and execute those concepts and lead the execution of those concepts. So for example, this company is called Chic Shoes, and it was a great opportunity for me that I got right out of college from UCLA, coming in as their head of marketing, and then eventually becoming their, with the director of marketing, then eventually becoming their VP of marketing and strategic partnerships. But I could pitch ideas to the owner. And one of those ideas was called Chic Music, which was to develop a platform to support artists who were local to our retail stores. And we had some artists who are now pretty established, who are, you know, big artists now, like the artists that I met early on, like Kendrick Lamar and an artist named YG and Ty Dolla $ign, who are all major recording mm-hmm. artists signed to major labels now, who were, you know, young teens or early 20s when I met them, who were local to, you know, who lived near Chic store. But I came up with a lot of ideas at Chic, and one of those was I was starting to develop just as I got laid off. I started to think about how we could improve our music video experience in our stores. And at the time, the company acquired another company, had more employees and so forth, and I ended up getting laid off as a part of the acquisition. But the founder of the company, the owner, hired me and my company to execute on another project for him. And in that opportunity, during that time, I was, you know, started to think more about how can we improve the music video experience in the store. So I started developing an in-store music video network, looking at all the competitors and what they were offering price point wise, service wise, technology wise, and started to think about how, you know, what I could offer to small to medium size retail chains and individual, you know, franchise stores. And I started to build what was called Maven Promo, which is an in-store music video network, and went and talked to labels about promoting artists and so forth. And that was the first company I sold. I ended up selling that several years later. It was 5 years later. And that was the first music tech company that I sold. And that started this, what became a series of music tech companies, or tech companies within the music industry, I think that's a better way of describing it, that I founded and then later sold. But the other two acquisitions were a little bit more interesting.
I don't know why my brain went to crunchy. that there was texture to the departure, and yes, then how you learn from it, right? You teach entrepreneurship now and how to start a business. If you look at how you started that first company that you sold, would you tell yourself something different? I mean, did you do a business plan? Did you do a market scan? Did you do kind of a logical start to it? Or did you really start that business now different than you would have today?
Well, that's interesting that you ask that, because I think most entrepreneurship professors of any kind, we teach fundamental principles about entrepreneurship, and we teach methodologies that I think the business industry or the business sector, especially in academia, subscribe to as theory or as practical, and have real life implication, especially if you work in a consultancy firm. But the first 10 businesses that I founded did not, I didn't go through the same process that I teach, or the process that I utilize with my consulting clients in terms of having deliverables that are SWOTs, or market research, or competitive analysis, and things like that.
SWOTs, strength, weakness, opportunity, threats, are just a I was going to say bare bones, but they can be sophisticated. What's happening internally and externally to your organization?
Right. So the first, I didn't know those concepts. So to suggest that I went through, a PESTO analysis or environmental analysis, or understanding the market size and the TAM, we all talk about the total addressable market.
You're going fast through those comments. So yeah. PESTO, we've got looking at the political, economic, societal, technological, and whatever people put on that, values or whatever. So we look at look at the future opportunity set. And then what was the last one you just said?
So I said the PESTO analysis, the SWOT analysis, and then there's a number of various theories or frameworks that
that we academic-y people tell people to go through. But then you started this company mostly saying there was an opportunity.
Right. I started with the opportunity. The opportunity came out of my real world problems. Right. So I was already it's interesting because all of the technology businesses that I've created came out of the actual problem that I faced already, and needed to create a technical solution for. So when I created the Maven Promo, the digital in-store music video network, was because for 5 years, or for actually 20 something years, the retail chain had been using CDs or VHS tapes before that to receive and distribute music videos to stores, which caused a lot of problems. For example, the DVD would be, it was scratch up because it'd be overused. They couldn't get new music more frequently. So as an employee, you're hearing the same playlist of music
over and over. Yeah.
Right. So, but with something that was cloud-based, and at the time, the idea of building a cloud-based venture was very popular, and we were using cloud, the term in the cloud and all that stuff. So to build a cloud-based music video network enabled us to address, some of these, this problem, right? The value proposition was very clear. And yes, I did do a competitive analysis in terms of looking at who else was in the space providing music for retail. What was the cost? What were their features? What were the service offering? So I did some of the stuff, but not all of the stuff. I started working on this before I went to grad school. When I went to grad school, I actually took a class on management and entrepreneurship, and so I learned more concepts. And those concepts I was able to apply later on to other businesses, and also in my consulting work. I went to CSUN, California State University, Northridge, to get a master's in music industry administration. This particular degree program was a joint venture between the Mike Curb College, which housed the music industry program. So we took music industry courses, but also the David Nazarian School of Management, which housed the MBA program and all the other sort of business economics programs. So we took traditional MBA classes from financial managerial accounting to organizational management and what you would take getting an MBA, marketing, and then entrepreneurship. And, you know, I was able to do a couple of things. One is to put a name or a concept to things that I was already doing and just didn't know it. And then also better frameworks around things that I was currently doing and didn't do it from the perspective of here's something laid out as a framework to do this thing, like the SWOT analysis, for example. I understood what my strengths and weaknesses were. I didn't know what a SWOT analysis was. So to take concepts and to be able to, you know, I think bring some of the work that I was already doing into a conceptual framework that had much more context I was able to understand. And that was what happened in grad school, is that I simply just learned more about business from a theory standpoint, and was able to then look at the different tools, and I call them tools. And when I teach, I call them tools. I said, these are all tools for building and establishing your business, a business idea and vetting an idea. So yeah, it was certainly a process that I kind of picked up over time while I was simultaneously, you know, starting businesses and getting better and better over time from the lessons I was able to learn in my setbacks and failures, but also in the lessons I was able to take from, you know, the frameworks and that I was able to gather as a grad student.
So what have you learned that you can publicly share about selling for companies?
Yes, and this is super key. So, you know, I've been working as a mentor or an advisor to startups over the last several years, some through programs like the Southwest Music, which I've done for 4 or 5 years. I'm also a mentor through the Capital Music Group, G Beta Music Tech Accelerator, since it's been founded. So I've done about, I think they've had 3 cohorts. They're in their 3rd cohort right now. And I just mentored, I'm currently mentoring some of those founders. I've mentored founders in other accelerator programs and so forth. But what I like to let all founders understand is that you need to vet your investors and you need to vet your buyers very well. And I say this because you can get very excited as a founder of having an acquisition, you know, especially if you want to have that acquisition, as opposed to, you know, doing a fire sale out of a need to, make sure that your bills are paid or that your, you know, that your business isn't going under. But when you're doing an exit, you want to make sure you vet your investors and your, vet your buyers. And if you're getting investors, you want to vet your investors. And that's all I can say on that. vet your investors and vet your buyers. Make sure that you're aligned. In regards to investors, you want to make sure that you're aligned. You know, what you as a founder see as the future of your business is aligned with what your investors believe they want to support and invest into. You want to, in terms of investors, you also want to make sure that they are who they say they are and that they have the resources that they say they have.
I would also say that there's always surprises. So even though you can vet people, there still are things. I mean, to me, it's a little like getting married in the fact that, you know, you think you know somebody, and then when you're actually having to work with them, suddenly it's the, and I've been happily married for 30 something years, we still learn things about each other, but it still is the, I think I know this, but you still need to kick the tires as much as humanly possible. But there's things that you're surprised about all the time in people that you're doing business with. It's just such a definitive thing when you're selling a company.
Right. Yes. I think that you need to do something. You can't do nothing. You know, I'm saying this because I did nothing, right? So the first time, you know, the lesson that I learned is that the first time I let my company get acquired, we didn't do any vetting whatsoever of the buyer. And this was not a acquisition where we walked away as founders. It was an acquisition where we also got hired as employees. So you had to then work for the company that owned your company. And then that's where we start to learn more about the founders of that company and the company itself. So it's really important that you vet your investors, and then also vet your buyers. There's been scenarios where, you know, you want to make sure that your buyer has the resources that they say they have to continue to execute on the vision that you've come to align with. So there's an entire process now that I could, you know, write up, and obviously I have written it up because I'm now teaching about it, but you need to make sure that, you know, there's alignment, between, you know, where you see the roadmap, like what is the product roadmap? Where do you see this going? What potential, you know, industries it will, or what potential, you know, how you're going to differentiate or diversify or enter new markets, all those questions, if you intend to be a part of the future of the business. Now, there are scenarios where you simply want to sell the business and be done with it, and you don't really care or don't care as much about where the new founder or where the new owner may take it. And then in which case you may not vet them more than making sure they have the finances to close on the deal, which is also
you're bequeathing phenomenal employees into this space too, and clients as well. So there is that sense of it, but it's not as much as you're tied to it as having then a working contract that you have to stay to get paid out.
Right. Yeah. What you don't want to do at the end of the day, what you don't want to do is have to buy back your company. So,
which you've done at least once. So that's a whole nother podcast. We could talk on that.
Yes. I've done it twice.
I want to spend our last time talking about though, how this turned into your now adventures. So the past couple of startups you've had that you've sold or that you have found new homes for have been looking at how artists deal with rights and how artists get their information into the system and finding money in systems. And I find it fascinating from that, that you then moved over into being the head of third party partnerships for the MLC. So it's almost like you've taken all those superhero capabilities that you've earned and learned through and now are bringing them to a new venture that is working in essence for many different organizations to make this stuff happen. Can you talk a bit about what you're doing, what the MLC is, what you're doing there, and then how these superpowers are moving over?
Sure. The MLC stands for the Mechanical Licensing Collective, and it is a nonprofit organization that has been designated by the United States Copyright Office to administer the new blanket mechanical license, which is a license required for digital service providers such as Spotify and Apple and Tidal to be able to play songs or to have songs made available on their platforms in the United States. This license comes out of a legislation that passed in 2018 called the Music Modernization Act, and the MLC, the idea of the MLC comes out of that act as well. So my role as one of the on the leadership team is the head of third-party partnerships. In that regard, I develop and execute the MLC's strategy for partnering with various types of organizations, companies, individuals, consortiums within the music industry for the purpose of supporting and empowering publishers and self-administered songwriters who are our members. Also, to simply be active and engaged in the music industry as a thought leader, as a participant in the United States music industry, through education, through industry advancement opportunities, and so forth. Part of my role is also to engage with tech startups in the music rights space, which I've spent the last several years building software in that space and building startups in that space. So I'm very knowledgeable about that space and the players in that space. And my role is to interact with those companies and startups and figure out ways how to partner with them where it makes sense for us at the MLC and in terms of our support to publishers and songwriters. So one of the ways we're doing that is through an initiative called the Data Quality Initiative. And that initiative is about helping publishers check their music catalog data in bulk with the MLC to make sure that their information is correct, so that when we license, when we receive royalties from digital services and have to account to publishers, we have the accurate information to process their royalties. So I have been working over the last several months with a number of companies that have built technical solutions to support publishers, such as catalog management, or rights administration, or royalty processing, so that they can connect with us through this data quality initiative on behalf of their clients, which are publishers. So that's one partnership initiative, and we have a number of partners that we're going to be announcing that we already announced earlier this year the Stax Music Maestro, which was the first example of what the data quality initiative could look like. We've recently brought on four other companies that are helping publishers at all levels. So Blocker, Tune Registry, Music Data Services, and Exactuals are companies that demonstrate my commitment and our commitment as an organization to support publishers at all levels, because these services are economical and some of them are more expensive, but it kind of goes back to our commitment to support publishers at all levels. So what's interesting is that my role is to come up with strategic partnerships. I'm also coming up with partnerships with other types of organizations, membership organizations. There's two companies that I'm talking to that are supporting Latin music creators, specifically in terms of making sure that there's content in Spanish for them to understand what the license is or their rights to join. I have an initiative called the Cultural Partnerships, where we're standing up, I'm going to be standing up programs to support music creators from historically marginalized communities, such as Black music creators, Latinx music creators, LGBT music creators, and Asian music creators. And I've already began outreach to organizations and all those little categories, as well as individuals who are sort of thought leaders in those categories. So it's bringing, all these things that I've done in the past, creating strategic ideas, creating synergy between two or more organizations, launching those, realizing those synergies in the form of initiatives and programs, vetting companies to partner with, creating ideas around technologies such as APIs that can interact with our portal at MLC. So a lot of things that I've done over the years is all kind of bundled up into this role. And as a matter of fact, when I read the job description for this role, I emailed my boss, at the time it was my boss, but the CEO, Chris, and I said, "This is a really exciting job description. It's so befitting of me and my background." And he tells me that, "Yeah, I spent hours studying your LinkedIn and your website and built this role for you, based off of your background in the music industry and your role as a CEO entrepreneur and your role as an advisor and mentor to startups. It all kind of comes together in this role. So it's a really exciting role. It's one that I didn't really have any, in my kind of trajectory when I was in high school, I didn't think I'd be working for a quasi-governmental nonprofit, but I am. But it's doing the things that I've been doing for many years, and in a way that really has an impact on a lot of publishers and songwriters in the U.S. So it was really exciting.
Do you get a chance to sing anymore?
Yes, my shower still exists. So I actually went to a friend of mine hosted a small little karaoke gathering last night, very last minute. And we had fun doing that. I actually put a few stories on my Instagram. Yeah, I haven't pursued singing as a talent, as an artist. I do remember when I was my first job outside of UCLA, after I graduated UCLA, was at Chic Shoes as a marketing manager. And I developed their music category, and that included everything from actually selling music in the stores, physical CDs, to developing our music download store online, overseeing the development of it, actually designing a wireframe for what it looked like. But one of the things I did was started a multi-city talent search. And through that talent search, you know, we went into the malls. I set up a stage, and we auditioned. You know, we allowed youth to submit to this talent search that we're doing, and with Reebok as a partner, as a sponsor. And I had judges, and I remember just listening to, you know, the various contestants, very American Idol style. And just kind of having flashbacks to when I was an aspiring artist and going to those things. And now I'm on the other side, creating these platforms, creating these opportunities to empower and support artists. But I do remember, and it's been, you know, I've had those little moments all the time, even when I managed artists and was in the studio with artists as they're recording their projects. And, you know, and my role as the executive producer to finance that studio time, to finance that, mixing engineer to pay for the release of that album. So it was interesting just kind of looking back at that transition from, you know, when I was the aspiring artist to, you know, when I moved to this role of empowering and investing in aspiring artists.
So Day, you have, and we've only touched on some of your adventures, but we're pretty much at the end of our conversation. Who would you like to reach out to you? How should they reach out? And is there anything we haven't touched yet that we might have time for?
Yes. So if you are listening and you work in the music publishing space and you're a publisher, or if you are an artist and you own your own copyrights, you should certainly reach out to me in regards to the MLC, the Mechanical Licensing Collective. Beyond that, you know, I have a number of free resources online for music industry entrepreneurs who want to, you know, who have questions about licensing or marketing or, you know, building go-to-market strategies or, you know, understanding what a competitive analysis is. All these little things, I do have resources online. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. Just search Day Bogan. I think I'm the only one. And you can also connect with me on social medias, which is Day Bogan Music. It's Day Bogan Music on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And you know, anyone I think who is either a music creator and would potentially need to join the MLC, or, you know, a founder of a company that needs to or would like to learn more about, you know, the way that I teach entrepreneurship and what I've done in my past, I can point to some resources potentially.
Great. And we'll have that stuff in the show notes. Day, thank you very much for joining us, and thanks for sharing just the tip of the iceberg at your adventures. We'll try to have you back on to dig even deeper in some of this stuff.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Day. All right. Well, there's the adventure. I hope you found this inspirational. If you are interested, please find them to participate in their work through our show notes or their social media, and come back to future episodes of Creative Innovators to get inspired in your work. And if you'd like to rebuild your career, come find us at nextcareer.me to take our next career program to figure out what you might do as your new adventures as a creative innovator.